Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana Luncheon Series, produced by Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. This month's speaker is Scott A. Hodge. He's the president of the Tax Foundation. It's a nonpartisan tax research group based in Washington, D.C. Hodge will talk about how new President Barack Obama is doing, fulfilling his campaign promises.
We are very fortunate today to have our speaker. It's very timely. We've all heard the old Benjamin Franklin adage that nothing is certain but death and taxes. While taxes may be unavoidable, our speaker today frequently and fervently works to help educate taxpayers on sound policy and the size of the tax burden. Scott Hodge is president of the Tax Foundation, a nonpartisan tax research group based in Washington, D.C. While Hodge believes low tax rates are good, they're not everything. He says whether a rate is high or low, it will be unfair and inefficient if the tax base is riddled with credits, deductions, and exemptions. Hodge has authored 3 books and more than 100 studies on tax policy and government spending. He's written dozens of editorial and opinion columns for national newspapers and has been interviewed more than 600 times for radio and television reports by outlets such as CNN, NBC Nightly News, C-SPAN, and so on. During the 90s, Hodge led the effort to include the $500 per child credit and capital gains tax cuts in the Contract with America, cuts that were later enacted. Hodge says the tax policies proposed by both McCain and President Obama during their campaigns would increase the number of Americans who pay no personal income taxes. He says if Obama's tax provisions are enacted, the number of these non-payers would rise by about 16 million to 63 million overall. He believes the public needs to consider whether that's a good idea, to have so many Americans who are disconnected from the cost of government. Today he will discuss taxes, inequality, and the direction of America. I, like each of you, look forward to hearing his remarks. Please join me in a warm welcome for Scott Hodge.
Well, thank you very much, Steve, and thanks to the Economic Club of Indiana for this opportunity, and it's really an honor. I appreciate it a great deal. I apologize, my voice is a little harsh. I seem to have come down with something. It's sweeping Washington. I think it's called bailout-itis. We are tired of bailing people out. There seems to be no end of hands out for a bailout. I do have Indiana roots. This is like back home to Indiana for me. When I was a kid, back in the 60s, my dad was going to IU. I have many, many fond memories of living in Bloomington, going to the Little 500, going down to Brown County to see the fall colors and so forth. So it's nice to be back, although it's awfully damn cold out there. I also have another root here or connection, shall I say, and that is one of my former star tax attorneys, Chris Atkins, where are you, Chris, is now here working with the Office of Management and Budget. There he is in the back. And I'm sure that while the Tax Foundation is worse off, having Chris come here, Indiana is better off, and at least your tax policy is better off because he's here. It's a little intimidating. I've told that P.J. O'Rourke was your last speaker. Now, I know P.J. O'Rourke, and I am no P.J. O'Rourke. Johnny Carson once said, never follow an Animal Act or a Child Act. So I don't know where PJ fits into that. I could sort of repeat some of his stories. One of my favorites is The Revenge of the Euro Weenies. That's probably not too PC, though, for this crowd. Another one that's really timely today, that was, written 15 years ago, some odd, I think, that could just as well apply to the stimulus bill, and that was his assessment of the 1996 Ag Bill, the Farm Bill of 1996. And PJ's only real experience with farming was going out to a friend's farm in Virginia to help him inseminate his prize cow. Now, PJ was fortunately on the other end of the cow, but he said, "I'll never forget the look on that cow's face when my friend inserted the bovine marital device, because I had the same look on my face, and for the very same reason, when I read the 1996 Farm Bill." Now, for anybody who's read the 600-page stimulus bill worth $900 billion that just is working its way through the Senate, are having much the same feeling. But I'm not here to talk about that necessarily. We will get into talking about the stimulus bill because all of this stuff ties together. But I am, I guess, talking something a little bit more serious than PJ would, and that is taxes, inequality, and the direction of America. And for those of us who have been kicking around for a while, the economy today must look eerily similar to that in which Ronald Reagan inherited when he took the oath of office in January 1981. Like Reagan, Barack Obama faces an economy that's in recession, rampant federal spending, rising deficits, depleted state coffers, and Americans demanding change. As Yogi Berra used to say, it's deja vu all over again. But while the economic problems may be similar, the men and their philosophies are not. The change that President Obama is promising could not be more different from what Ronald Reagan instituted during his first year in office. Unlike Reagan, who promised to cut the top individual tax rates from 71% to 50%, Barack Obama has pledged to increase taxes on upper-income Americans in order to pay for tax cuts for middle-income Americans and increase spending on a host of new spending programs. In other words, he plans to actively use federal tax and spending policy to redistribute income according to a progressive philosophy of equity and fairness. The new administration's agenda is based on the premise that government tax and spending policies are not progressive enough and not doing enough to reduce income inequality in America. And that after all of the talk of rising inequality that we heard last year, it's no wonder that a lot of Americans have similar opinions. In fact, according to a Gallup poll conducted last year, 68% of Americans felt that money and wealth should be more evenly distributed. And 51% of us said the government should redistribute wealth by heavier taxes on the rich. This is a much more redistributionist, try saying that three times fast, attitude than when the question was asked in 1939, when only 35% of Americans thought they needed higher taxes on the rich. But to me, these trends in public opinion raise some interesting questions. Are these public attitudes based on fact or misperception? How progressive is federal tax policy, both taxes and spending? And how much income does the government redistribute from one side of the ledger to another, from one group of Americans to another? And really, how much do households get in government benefits compared to what they pay in taxes? Do some get less? Do some get more? Or is it basically an even trade? It'd be nice to have answers to these questions, because at their most basic level, government budgets are about who gets what and who pays for it. In other words, the distribution of spending and tax policy. And even though Obama's first budget will outline more than $6 trillion worth of combined tax and spending policies, no one in Washington, not even his own Office of Management and Budget, can put together a complete picture of who pays the taxes and who gets the spending. Now, yes, there are a number of groups in Washington, including the Tax Foundation, that do distributional analysis of taxes, you know, who pays the tax burden and so forth. But no one does the equal thing on the spending side of the ledger and then matches it up to see if that's an equitable balance. And because we have this lack of information, budget debates are really waged in separate battles over discrete parts of the budget, rather than a broader public debate about how much redistribution we should have or how much less we should be redistributing. And this allows interest groups to advance expensive tax and spending policies in a very piecemeal fashion, because they don't have to explain how much additional money their plans would redistribute or cost Americans somewhere down the line. But another reason to really worry about this lack of information is that Washington is about to be hit by the perfect storm of the expiration of the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts, combined with an explosion of Americans that are being hit under the alternative minimum tax, combined with the crisis that we will soon face with major entitlement programs such as Medicare and Social Security. And that's why I'm pleased to announce, this lack of information is why I'm pleased to announce, that the Tax Foundation has launched a major new research effort that promises to close this information gap in Washington's fiscal accounting system. It's a project that we believe will change the terms of the tax and spending debate while giving lawmakers both the tools they need to make better policy, but more importantly, giving the public the tools that they need to understand what is actually happening. But before I talk about some of our preliminary findings, I'm going to take a few minutes to conduct a little thought experiment to get your minds warmed up to talking about tax and budget issues. And then we'll take a few minutes to put a face on America's tax payers and talk about how the vast demographic changes that we've seen over the past five decades should change our attitudes toward inequality. I feel like Orson Welles standing up here. I'd like to start out talking about justice as fairness. In many respects, the philosophical underpinnings of today's progressive movement can be traced to the work of the late Harvard professor John Rawls. And for those of you who, like me, slept through Philosophy 101, Rawls' seminal book, Justice as Fairness, tried to square the competing virtues of individual freedom with justice. And to get there, Rawls designed a thought experiment that begins with the original position in which we human beings set out to design the society that we would prefer, but from scratch. And he complicates this effort by placing us all behind the veil of ignorance, which is not like the cone of silence. The veil of ignorance is one that we don't know anything about our personal attributes. We don't know our intelligence. We don't know our abilities, our station in life, or our inherent intelligence. Essentially, Rawls is asking us, what kind of social structure and social rules would you want if you not only knew nothing about yourself, but knew nothing about the others in society? So let's pretend to be behind the veil of ignorance and choose which of these two societies that we would want to live in simply based upon the relative distribution of wealth within this society. Society number one is a relatively equal society. Those in the middle command about twice the wealth of those at the bottom. And at the same time, those at the top command about twice the resources of those in the middle. Yes, there's inequality, but not very dramatic. On the contrary, we see society number two, which is dramatically unequal. The top 20% of those people in that society command over half of that society's resources. In fact, twice as much as the bottom three income groups combined. So not knowing anything about yourself, which one would you choose to live in? And I'll pick on you right up front. Number one, and why? Because it's more equitable. And you? The same. Number two, and why? A dissenter. Because there's more people and more wealth, and you're rolling the dice and hoping you're one of them? I'm sorry? Better society. Well, this is an interesting thought experiment, because society number one is Bulgaria in 1995. where the per capita GDP was just a little under $1,400 a year. At that time, Bulgaria was actually considered to have the least amount of inequality in Europe, and that's because everyone was poor. Society number two, get ready, is the Forbes 400 last year, in which the median net wealth was $3.9 billion, and the poorest member of the group was worth $1.3 billion. That happened to be Sandy Weil of Citigroup, but I doubt he's on that list anymore. But what should we take away from this thought experiment? Well, first, under Rawls' reasoning, we should have, and because we don't know anything about our abilities because of the veil of ignorance, we all should have chosen society number one. Because we want institutions in place that prevent vast inequality from happening in society. To be honest with you, I think Rawls was somewhat of, maybe a lot, a pessimist. And this appears to be what motivated a lot of voters in last November's election. But I think that this little thought experiment also draws attention to America's bipolar nature, because the other half of Americans would choose society number two under the belief that America's prosperity is the result of the more optimistic notion that we can get ahead, we can prosper, we can make something of ourselves no matter what our circumstances or station in life. That old pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality. In other words, a lot of Americans value opportunity more than they value equality. And so if these optimists were designing a society from scratch, they would reject any policies that prevent people from rising as high and as far as they possibly could. And interestingly enough, the actual distribution of income among U.S. taxpayers is roughly similar to the distribution of wealth within the Forbes 400. And so I think that we need a very serious public discussion of the consequences of trying to move from this to this. And we almost had that debate during the waning days of the election, right after Barack Obama admitted to Joe the Plumber that he preferred to spread the wealth around. Unfortunately, John McCain was so inept at engaging Obama in the debate, and Obama admittedly was very clever in deflecting it by talking about sharing his peanut butter sandwich and that kind of thing, that we never got the debate we deserved. And that was really, this is the essence of the debate that should have been held during the election. Well, then there's the ever-present question of, is the middle class falling behind? And President Obama has appointed Joe Biden to head a task force to develop policies to, quote, improve the living standards of middle-class families. And this is sure to be popular, because when pollsters ask us to put ourselves into one class or another in society, about 90% of Americans say that they're middle class. And that's because Americans see middle class not as a point on the income scale, but as a value system. A value system that connotes intact, working families, doing the right thing, and raising children. But politicians and the media have too often equate middle income and middle class in a way that gives us warm and fuzzy feelings about Leave It to Beaver. But these notions of middle income families are as obsolete as vacuum tubes and black and white television sets. Anybody remember those? And although June and Ward Cleaver, the stereotypical middle-income family of four in 1960, may have also been once defined as the middle class, today's middle-income family is not our family, our father's middle-income family. You know, but images die hard in Washington, and policy tends to drag on with these outdated images. Look at agriculture policy. You'd think that America's farmers had just walked out of a Steinbeck novel, Grapes of Wrath or something. It may be surprising to some, but June and Ward Cleaver have retired, and they've been replaced by a new middle-income taxpayer, Phoebe and Joey, from the cast of the popular TV series Friends. In June and Ward's day, 65% of all tax returns were filed by married couples. Today, just about 40% of all tax returns are filed by married couples. And if we look specifically at the statistical middle income group, which I call the political middle class, in 1960, there were twice as many married couples in that group, twice as many June and Wards, as there were Phoebe and Joeys. But today, that number has reversed. There are twice as many Phoebe and Joeys in the statistical middle, the political middle, as there are June and Ward. Phoebe and Joey have replaced June and Ward in the middle income. Overall, there are now about 82 million single or head of household taxpayers in America, compared to only 53 million married couples. And if we look at taxpayers earning under $50,000 a year, there are about 3.5 times as many singles as there are married couples. And the flip side is also true if we look above the $50,000 a year mark. There are 3.5 times as many marrieds as there are single taxpayers. And why is that? Well, one of the reasons that we have this trend is because we have a greater concentration of married couples at the top who are dual income. Today, 2 out of 3 working couples are dual earners, compared to less than half of all married couples in Leave It to Beaver's days. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist or a math major to understand that if you're just looking at a sterile tax return, one with two incomes on it will look wealthier than one with one. And these dual earner couples also tend to be college educated. They're older. They're business owners. A lot of them have S-corps, like my friend Steve here. They live in high-cost, high-tax urban areas and have incomes that match that higher cost of living. And every year, the economic return to education gets greater and greater. We did a study a few years ago looking at the educational composition of people at different income levels. And we found at the top that 8 out of 10 taxpayers in the highest income group had some college education or greater. And then when you look at the bottom, 6 out of 10 of those folks have a high school education or less. So in a lot of respects, we don't have a income inequality in America. We have an education inequality. And another contributor to the perception of rising inequality is the army of baby boomers, like myself, who are nearing retirement, although I'm at the tail end. And naturally, when you have 70-odd million baby boomers who are reaching their peak earning years, they're going to look an awful lot wealthier than those 20-somethings who have just entered the workforce. But Phoebe and Joey are in for a shock. When they get married and combine their two incomes, they will move from the middle income group to the top simply by saying, "I do." And as Steve mentioned, today's working families also look rich compared to the 46 million tax filers who have no income tax liability after taking their credits and deductions. What that means is fully one-third of all so-called taxpayers pay zero in income taxes because of the generosity of credits and deductions that are available in today's code. And many of these folks not only don't have an income tax liability, but they also get what's known as a refundable tax credit, such as the earned income tax credit, back from the IRS. In fact, the government gives out about $50 billion a year in these kind of refundable tax credit checks. And in many respects, we've turned the IRS into an ATM machine for welfare benefits, which I'm sure is not a role that they relish. The stimulus plan that passed the House last week would further blur the lines between tax policy and spending policy by doling out an additional $82 billion in refundable tax credits, thus knocking even more people off the tax rolls. As you can see here, the lines have been growing year after year after year of people who have been knocked off the bottom. And we estimate that under the Obama plan, should it reach fruition, as many as 44% of all so-called taxpayers will have no income tax liability at all. So who's left paying the nation's tax bills? Despite what you hear from Warren Buffett, the rich really are paying the lion's share of all federal taxes in America, not just income taxes. Households earning over $200,000 a year now pay a greater share of the total federal tax burden than the bottom 90% combined. Let's put that in perspective. The top 2 million earners in America pay a greater share of the total federal tax burden than the bottom 122 million. And yet there are some who think that that's still not equitable. But Warren Buffett is not the only one with a completely misguided impression of the burden of taxation in America. Ask any American, which country is the most has the most progressive tax system? I'll pick on you again. Is it U.S. or Sweden? Which one has a more progressive tax system? Of course, you're thinking, oh, this must be a setup. It is a setup. Yes, the answer would be wrong if you said Sweden. It is the United States. According to a recent study by the Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD for short, the U.S. has the most progressive income tax system among industrialized countries, higher than Sweden or France or any of the other countries that we associate with highly progressive, highly burdensome taxes. And what this means, says the OECD, is that we place a higher income tax burden on those within the top 10% of our citizens than any other industrialized country. At the same time, our low-income taxpayers have one of the lowest income tax burdens among industrialized countries, largely because we've paid so many to get off the tax rolls. What's ironic about this, actually, is that despite the fact that the OECD says that we try harder than any other industrialized country to reduce inequality by using taxation, we still have one of the most unequal societies within the industrialized world. Only Portugal, Turkey, and Mexico have higher levels of inequality than the United States. So either we have inequality in spite of highly progressive tax code, or progressive taxation is not a very effective tool for blunting income inequality. In any case, I think we are overdue for an honest debate about this issue. All right, I've been dawdling long enough. I would like to unveil the project that I talked about. And we believe that this will be a major contributor to the discussion over tax and spending policy in the months and years to come. Essentially, what we want to understand are two basic questions. How much does a family pay in taxes versus how much do they receive in government spending? From all types of spending, from Social Security and national defense to agriculture subsidies and welfare benefits. And then we want to know how much redistribution actually occurs through both tax and spending policy, because both work hand in hand. And while our initial report will come out in a few weeks, I can share some preliminary results that I think you'll find kind of interesting. It's not ready for citation yet, however. Basically, our study shows that today's upper-income working households are not only shouldering their own tax burden, but the tax burden of millions of their fellow citizens. Overall, it looks as though the federal government is redistributing roughly $1 trillion a year from the top 30% of families in America to the bottom 70%. That's more than what they're talking about spending in the stimulus package is being redistributed in 1 year. And about half of those redistributed funds are coming from the top 1% of families. And it's a little easier to understand when you break it down on an individual case-by-case basis. And here, and it may be difficult for those in the back to see, is households at various income groups, what we call deciles, where we've split the population into 10 equal parts. And this represents the ratio of what people get in spending compared to what they pay in taxes at various income levels. This is actually an analysis of Bush's last budget, the FY 2009 budget, which we'll use as a benchmark for looking at future budgets, either from the Obama administration or ones that work their way through Congress. And what you see there at the bottom is that the lowest income Americans get about $29 in federal spending, almost $30 in federal spending, for every dollar that they pay in taxes. And that's not surprising. They obviously have very little cash income and receive a lot of income support and from the social safety net. But what is surprising is that families in the so-called forgotten middle class, or at least middle income, are still receiving more in government spending than they pay in taxes. And it's not until you get to about the 80th percentile, which if you're looking at tax returns is somewhere in about the $80,000 range, do people start to get less back in government spending than what they pay in taxes. And if you move further up the income ladder to the 90, 95, and even further, people get between 50 cents and a nickel back for every dollar that they pay in taxes. Now, I can live with the fact that Warren Buffett and Bill Gates only get back a nickel in government benefits for every dollar that they pay in taxes. They can do well on their own. But what troubles me most is that we now are past the tipping point in which half of all Americans, more than half of all Americans, are getting more back from government than they are contributing. And I hate to say it, but John Edwards was right. We do have two Americas. We have a small minority of Americans who are shouldering all of the tax bills, and we have an ever-growing class of Americans who are consumers of government. And I think that we should be alarmed when you have a majority as consumers of government and a minority comprised especially of dual-income working couples and entrepreneurs. I think not only are we asking too much of these dual-income couples and entrepreneurs at the top, but we are setting the stage for social conflict between those who do consume government and will want ever more because they are not contributing to it, and those who pay for government and who will become increasingly resentful of those that they are subsidizing. And I think that this clash of taxpayers and tax consumers could tear at the fabric of our democracy. And setting that aside, you know, there's a practical public finance issue. You don't want to rely so heavily on the rich to pay to the government's tax bills, or you'll end up looking like California. California gets 84% of its income tax revenue from taxpayers earning more than $100,000 a year. And much of that is through volatile stock options, dividends, and business income. And that's why California collapsed during the last recession when capital gains revenue collapsed by 66%. And the same thing happened last year when capital gains collapsed again. They don't seem to learn. What's the definition of insanity? When you keep doing things the wrong way and, you know, whatever. Well, let's wrap this up so we can have time for Q&A. You know, Washington, as you know, has been fixated with jump-starting the economy right now as though it was a lawnmower that you could keep pulling the cord and bring it back to life. But like the economy, the lawnmower is flooded. And the more we pull on it, I think in many respects, the worse results we're going to get. And if nothing else, we'll get tired arms by trying too hard. We need to take a step back at this time rather than rushing into things and asking what kind of economy do we want in 10 or 20 years and setting the policies to get us to that place in the future. That's the kind of leadership America deserves, but what we're getting are policies driven by panic and short-term thinking, not reasoned long-term thinking. And ironically, our government's attempt to use tax policy to help the middle class by subsidizing certain areas of the economy, such as healthcare, housing and education, has not only produced a Byzantine tax system, but has also created an economic mess in the various areas that we tried to help. Housing, healthcare, and education are the most subsidized area of the tax code, but ironically are the most challenging and expensive for middle-class families. If I was advising Joe Biden's task force, I would say that the way to help middle-class families is to do less for them. Just implement policies that make all Americans richer. Don't try to pound the top back down to the bottom. Our attempts to promote equality should not produce mediocrity. Society number one. It is possible to dramatically simplify the tax code in a way that maintains progressivity while also improving economic efficiency and economic growth. And that's something both the left and the right can agree. But as we've seen, today's middle-class families are not our father's middle class. They're increasingly dual income, they're educated, they're older, and they're business owners, Those are all traits that we should value and not punish through punitive taxes and redistribution. Thank you very much for your attention.
Scott, now we'll go to the Q&A, and by all means, if you do have some questions, well, thank you, Deborah.
And they can be on up. They can be on anything.
One that's kind of topical here in our state, Scott, is that we have a debate going on about property taxes, specifically tax caps, and ironically, that the tax caps would be different between individuals and corporations. Real estate would be capped at 1%, while corporate real estate would be capped at 3%. Would you offer any comments on that?
Well, obviously there's an inequity in there, and I think what happens is that lawmakers tend to view businesses differently than individuals. You know, we always want to screw the businesses, you know. And, you know, there's this misperception that we can keep ladling costs and taxes onto the business community. It's almost like a victimless crime. But that's not the case at all. As most of us know, businesses don't pay taxes. People do. In the same way that cigarettes don't pay taxes, smokers do. Houses don't pay taxes, pay property taxes, people do. Buildings don't pay property taxes, people do. I think this inequity is rather unfortunate, and it gets all kinds of distortions that come from it. And I understand that it's an extremely sensitive issue in this state after last year's so-called reforms. I have anxiety over state-level property tax caps. You can get a lot of distortions that happen in, say, California, although these kind of caps can work in places like Massachusetts. But I think I worry most about state governments taking too much taxing authority away from local governments and what that does to blur the lines between the two and how much autonomy it actually takes away from local governments. But that's kind of a thing, different issue.
Got a question here we were discussing at lunch. Do you believe it was appropriate for the Senate to confirm the present Treasury Secretary, given his personal tax problems?
How to put this delicately? I think Mr. Geithner is going to have some credibility issues in managing the IRS after going through what he did. And I think that optics are very important and credibility is very important. But obviously the Senate decided that the times being what they were, they wanted his skills even at the cost of putting someone in place who did have those tax problems. But I maybe on a positive note, after this debacle with Daschle and the others, that maybe the Obama administration can get on board the move to fundamentally transform the tax system and simplify it rather than make it more complicated, which they're doing in the current stimulus bill, by adding hundreds of new tax credit provisions, which are actually going to ladle the code with even more complications, not less, and thus millions of people are going to end up in the same position as Geithner. You know, low-income people that I talked about who get the earned income tax credit, 70% of those low-income people must pay a professional tax preparer to do their tax return so that they can get the earned income tax credit. Doesn't that seem fundamentally wrong?
Actually got a couple questions here on the use of tax credits because the current plan does particularly encourage tax credits for big purchases like first-time home buyers, buying an automobile, so on and forth. I think I can anticipate your response, but role do you believe credits should play in this bailout plan, if any at all?
Well, zero. A lot of this is political opportunism, political posturing. That car credit is really bad tax policy. I'll just kind of keep it at that. The use of tax credits has, and I will take some responsibility for creating a climate in which tax credits are okay. because as my bio says, I was part of implementing the $500 per child tax credit contract with America, which got enacted in 1997. And since then, we have not only seen an explosion of people knocked off the tax rolls, but we've seen an explosion in the use of tax credits, which is using the tax code for social policy. And we're getting to the point now where we actually are beginning to push on a string, because there is very little income anymore to give tax credits against, especially in the low to middle income groups. And so because of this dilemma, we are now resorting to these refundable credits, essentially now handing out checks to people who simply don't pay taxes. We're tying ourselves in knots here, and it's time to, I think, start working toward some fundamental tax reform and get us out of this bind. But it's very, very difficult to do, because people see that as they're seeing a lot of people, too many people see April 15th as payday, and not tax day.
Do you think the alternative minimum tax should be abolished?
Yeah, that's a tricky one about the alternative minimum tax. You know, the AMT is like the blob that ate New York. You know, it spilled out of a petri dish, you know, in some college campus and, you know, turned into, you know, a B-movie sort of thing. You know, it was meant to capture or keep 154 wealthy families from using various tax deductions such as dry oil wells and so forth from zeroing out their tax liability. And rather than eliminating the tax provisions that these people use to get out of paying their tax bills, Congress created this parallel tax system called the AMT. Now millions of people are getting hit by it. I would like to go back to the original solution, and that is to eliminate the tax breaks that cause people or allow people to dramatically minimize their tax burden. The majority of people who take things like the mortgage interest deduction, the state and local tax deduction, and many of these other tax deductions earn well over $100,000 a year. The vast majority of these credits actually are taken by upper-income people. So if you're talking about equity, that would be a good place to start. We can dramatically simplify the tax system, make the tax code more progressive, and if we lower the rate so that these people didn't need those credits to lower their tax burden, we could have a simpler system, a much more equitable system, and one that's actually more conducive than economic growth, rather than trying to distort the economy through these politically generated tax provisions.
Sort of a continuation on that theme, are you an advocate of the fair tax or the national sales tax, or, in other words, what in your belief would be the ideal income tax scenario?
The ideal income tax is one that has one rate on the broadest base possible and implemented in the simplest way possible. Now, some would advocate that that is the fair tax or national retail sales tax. I have a lot of problems with that from not only a transition issue, trying to get from where we are to the fair tax, but I have some problems with the way that it's implemented. I'm much more favorable to the flat tax as advocated by Steve Forbes and others. Because I think the transition from where we are today to there would be a whole lot easier. And is much in line with what I talked about in terms of the solution to the AMT, the flat tax would essentially do exactly that. Broaden the base, lower the rates, do it on a postcard, send it in, we're all done.
You make a compelling discussion about, you know, how income is distributed and how many people are not paying any taxes. Do you think there's a floor at which maybe you shouldn't have to pay taxes? And if so, where would that be?
That's a tricky one. We conducted a nationwide poll 2 years ago in which we asked a question, as we say that, 46 million people who don't pay any income taxes after credits and deductions, do you think this is fair, or do you think people should pay at least something toward the cost of government? And well over 65% of adult respondents said that it was not fair and that people should pay at least something toward the cost of government. I do think that people need to be connected to government. I didn't used to say that. The libertarian in me didn't want to pay any taxes. I still don't. But I'm not going to go as far as Geithner. But I think we all need a connection to government, whether it's the roads, whether it's street sweeping, whether it's national defense. We need a connection to it. And the more we are disconnected from it, then the more we can demand from it at no cost to ourselves, because, you know, it's the old adage about, you know, tax that guy behind the tree. And that's where we're at today.
Kind of along the same lines, on the other end of the scale, and assuming we do continue to have some sort of progressive individual income tax, and in the context of having an alternative minimum tax and then getting to the super rich, the Forbes 400, you know, where is the taxing authorities, where do they define rich, and where might you define rich?
Where is rich? Yeah, that was an increasing, interesting topic throughout the presidential debate, too, because everyone had their own definitions. I think rich is probably a point in which you have your own staff. Not the cleaning lady, because I fall into that. I'm a pig. But where you actually do have staff. And once upon a time, people say, well, when you have two homes. Well, you know, there are a lot of guys that work on Ford assembly plants that have, you know, a cottage out in the on the lake and what have you. But I think, yes, multiple homes begins to do it. But certainly the point in which you're actually employing people within your home, that I think is rich. What dollar figure that is, I don't know.
What today in the tax code today, when does alternative minimum kick in?
Well, the alternative minimum tax, you know, can kick in as low as really $40,000 to $60,000 a year. They're trying to they up the cap to $60,000 a year. But if you look at the top 1% of taxpayers, that actually kicks in at about $350,000 a year in income. So that really is the bottom floor for what many would consider, you know, the rich, the top 1%. And then you can go on beyond there to look at, you know, the Forbes 400. By the way, the IRS just released a study when they look back for 15 years at the Forbes 400. Actually, it's the top 400 taxpayers. And only 17% of the individuals who collectively were on that list over a 15-year period had been on the list more than once. And something only like 25% had been on there twice or more. So the Forbes 400, as Sandy Weill just proved, is an ever-constant churning list of people who go in and off. And there's very rarely do people stay on for long periods of time. And I think that's a good thing, because it tells you how dynamic the American economy is, and that the rich are not a monolith. And that we have to look at it a little bit differently.
I hope you know what this is, because I don't, but it sounds interesting. Please comment on the Bonner case and the Tax Foundation's position judicially enforcing right to quality education here in Indiana.
Oh, that was a ringer. Who gave that one? I don't remember. Chris, you could probably answer this better than me. I'll get you the answer on that. We've been trying to weigh in on these various lawsuits in which various groups are trying to force higher education spending using the courts, and we've been trying to push back on that because we really think that that is undermining public finance across the country. It's locking states into spending that oftentimes they can't afford, and it's making it very inflexible for them to maneuver in times such as these when they need to change. And it's also contrary to what most research finds, is that there's no correlation between spending and educational output. So it's based on a false premise. And I don't remember the Bonner case. I know I run the organization. I should know every policy, and I'll flog myself for that one.
Last question. Found your use of data in your upcoming study is going to be fascinating, but with where you see things going, what are some of the key elements that you think you'll be doing most of your research on in the coming 4 years?
Well, certainly this is going to be a key area for us, but one of the other areas that we're focusing very hard on in Washington is trying to raise public awareness of America's declining business competitiveness globally. The United States has the second highest overall corporate tax rate in the world. And over the past 24 years, every major industrialized country on earth has cut their corporate tax rates while we have stood still. The U.S. federal rate at 35% is so high that if every state in the union were to eliminate its own corporate income tax, they would still be subject to a higher corporate tax rate than France, higher than Japan, and higher than China, and you can go on down the list. We are essentially pricing ourselves out of the global economy. We have to do something soon to cut our corporate income taxes, or American workers will be the net losers. What we do know from economic research, that as much as 70% of the economic cost of business taxes falls on workers through lower wages and lower productivity. And that's because in a global economy, capital is very mobile, but workers aren't. Businesses can rise up and go to Dublin to take advantage of their 12.5% corporate tax rate, but it's pretty hard for me to move my family from here to Dublin to follow that job. And that's why when, you know, we talk about business taxes, people say, oh, you know, those guys are, you know, trying to cheat the U.S. Treasury. Well, the reality is they're trying to lower the cost of doing business, which is a good thing for workers, because that burden eventually falls on them. The more we can cut our business taxes, the more competitive the United States is going to be globally, but more importantly, the better off American workers will be, the more they will make, and the more prosperous and productive they will be in the long run. The other half or third of our agenda is on state and local business climate issues. We put a tremendous amount of resources into barnstorming around the country to try to promote tax competition between the states, to get legislators to understand that taxes matter to their business climates, and that they have to do something to make themselves more competitive as well. Because not only is Indiana competing against Ohio and California and Florida, but you're competing against Singapore and other states. So you have to understand you're dealing in a global environment. And you can't just see these things in parochial terms. And so we're doing what we can to educate legislators about that, rank the states in terms of their business friendliness on tax issues, and to try to make them more aware that it is up to them to make their states healthier in terms of their business climates.
Scott A. Hodge is the president of the Tax Foundation in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us for the Economic Club of Indianapolis. Next month's speaker is Dr. Gordon Lloyd. The historian and author will talk about why we should study the American founders. Lloyd is the author of 3 books on the American founding fathers and the author of 2 forthcoming publications on political economy. Make sure to join us then. Thanks for listening. I'm Mary Hartnett.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.